Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, Bonzo Dog Band and Radio Listening. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when I think we both did some clapping.
Yes, I think we did both do some clapping, but I don't want listeners, particularly listeners outside of the UK, to think that isolation and continued lockdown has forced us to start performing music, and that is why we've been clapping. We've been clapping in the bravo sense rather than the keeping rhythm sense.
Yes, the weekly clap for the NHS, which is, I think we're just on our fourth week of that now. And it's a nice opportunity to see other people as well as applauding the sterling work being done by the NHS.
I think technically, since the first week of this new tradition here in the UK, which we should acknowledge, I think we stole off some other European countries. It wasn't entirely original.
Why are they clapping for the NHS?
Well, the point is, the first week we were clapping for frontline workers in hospitals and all the NHS staff, etc. But did we not extend it to anybody who's doing an essential job?
Yeah.
I felt that, is it appropriate to review the the standard of the clapping week from week? I might set up a website.
I do every week.
Maybe
afterwards.
We could set up a website and all the people we could know who are opinionated about nonsense could participate in this. I have to say, where I live in Leytonstone, week three really felt like everyone was going through the motions, whereas this week it felt like people were really feeling it again. I think that may have been because someone not very far away set off quite a lot of fireworks just at 8 p.m. and that probably roused everybody else into clapping.
I agree. I think that, I think it's got shorter each week, but possibly more fervent. But week three definitely was a bit lackluster. I think we clapped for about a minute and then everyone sort of stopped and stood there and went, "Are we done?" And they went back inside.
Here where I am, first of all, there's some people across the road who always start at 7:59. So then you're in a sort of, well, does that mean I should start? Or am I going to be a stickler for the schedule and wait for exactly 8 p.m? But maybe they've got an old-fashioned clock on the mantelpiece that's just wrong. And then a little further up the street from them, I assume they've got kids because they've started banging a drum and doing a tambourine. Or I don't know, maybe they're adults who just like banging drums and playing a tambourine as part of the NHS clapping thing. I can't quite see them. They're a bit further down the street. But therefore, not just clapping, getting a little bit of percussion in there. You've got a full drum kit, haven't you? Couldn't you be out there on the street really getting going with the percussion?
I could. I'd have to get preparing earlier, but I guess I could.
Are you saying that the hard work and commitment of our NHS workers is not worth you putting your drum kit together on a Thursday evening?
Well, all right, you put it like that, I'll do it.
we will look out for footage of that.
I could be like that BBC weather presenter.
Yes.
He's a much better drummer than me.
Yes, that went viral this week, drumming to the BBC News music. Although I think he did concede, the BBC News music is really good. I mean, it's the best thing about BBC News. I mean, most of what follows the music's a bit rubbish. But the BBC's news music, is a guy, David Lowe, wasn't it, who composed it? And, I mean, they've been using that music for a long time now. That's how good it is. And I still love the bit at the end. You know how the BBC pips? So the Radio 4 pips are the last 10 seconds of it. Yeah. I love the way that integrates that. Even though they've been doing that for years and years and years now, it is really good. But yes, it was quite interesting seeing the weatherman drumming along in his living room to the BBC News music. Do Channel 4 have a weather person? I think the only news music that's better than the BBC News music is the Channel 4 news music.
Well, a controversial opinion there, blimey.
But I don't think... Do they do weather? It's a long time since I've watched the Channel 4 news. I don't know if they have a weather person or whether that weather person could drum. Anyway, I kind of feel that we've possibly gone on a slight tangent on this.
It does sort of feel like that, doesn't it?
On this edition of Setlist.
Is it because we're lacking human contact?
And before we get going, whatever it is we're here to talk about this week, I have to remind people that we have our lockdown webinars, which are kicking off. Well, if you're hearing this podcast...
Yeah, speaking of human contact.
As this podcast goes out, it will be kicking off tomorrow. So we're starting on... Tuesday, the 21st of April. And then we've got three webinars a week for the next 3 weeks. So making money from music, copyright, streaming, explaining digital marketing 2020, the Evolution Record deals. That's just the first three. And there are another six already in the diary after that. Loads of people have been booking in. It's really exciting that we're going to be able to connect with all of those people each afternoon, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 2:30 London time. So do check those out if you haven't already. It's a great chance to stay up to speed with what's happening in the music industry and also use lockdown to expand your knowledge about the inner workings of the music business. So if you go to cmuinsights.com/lockdownwebinars, you can still book in to all of those from the website there. Although, of course, the real reason why we're running these webinars, it's not to connect the music industry during lockdown. It's not to educate people and allow people to use this time to grow their knowledge of the music industry. The main reason for this is it amuses me to see what shit stock photos Andy pulls out of the ether to illustrate webinars on our social media.
I did pick a particularly bad one today.
So as these webinars start happening, we'll be having more posts on our Instagram about them, and it will be interesting to see just how terrible stock imagery gets used over the coming weeks as we talk about our various webinars. Maybe we should start putting some of our useful diagrams on there instead. But no, I think we'll stick with the terrible stock photos because you seem to have a real knack for finding them.
There's so many. But that's not what we're here to talk about this week. We are actually going to be discussing the positive and negative effects of COVID-19 on the commercial radio industry. But first, the surviving members of the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band have said that they will work with MPs and the Intellectual Property Office to close what they see as a loophole in UK trademark law that can result in bands losing control of their brands. That commitment comes at the end of a long drawn out legal battle with filmmaker Robert Carruthers, who'd worked with the band on various shows and projects since 2005.
Yes, this is a really interesting story, as you say, coming at the end of a interesting, tedious for the people who took part, but interesting and, dare I say it, entertaining for those of us looking on from the outside. This legal battle between the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band and this filmmaker and producer, Robert Carruthers. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of the litigation and the campaign that's going to come off the back of it, we probably should explain for our younger listeners, because we do have some younger listeners.
I think in this case, younger listeners is quite a wide demographic.
Well, anybody under the age of 56.
Yeah.
Is that how we're defining younger listeners?
Yeah.
We probably should define, also for non-UK listeners, did the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band get a big following internationally? Maybe they did.
Neil Innes was quite popular in the US.
Well, I suppose he had the Monty Python link, didn't he? So that helped. So tell us, for people who don't know, who the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band are.
Well, they were a comedy band who formed in the early 1960s. They came to prominence in the late 60s on the TV show Do Not Adjust Your Set, which also featured three future members of Monty Python's Flying Circus, which is what gave them that link that you mentioned before. Neil Innes went on to write songs for Monty Python, as well as performing with them at their live shows. He also wrote the song Death Cab for Cutie, which was used in the Beatles film Magical Mystery Tour. So you might not have heard of them, but they are not insignificant in pop cultural history. I don't know who's heard of them and who hasn't. They made up quite a big chunk of my childhood, so it's nice to talk about them. You should also seek out Sir Henry at Rawlison End, which was Vivian Stanchell, the other key member of the group's comedy radio series that he did after the band split up, that I think ran originally as a section on John Peel's Radio 1 show. But that's not what we're here to talk about. I've had to say it for a second time. We are here to talk about a legal dispute, because that's what we always talk about, certainly these days. So, yeah, give us some background on that, Chris Cook.
Yeah, don't worry, because it's a very entertaining lawsuit. As I say, tedious for the people who had to take part in it, but actually the judgment that came out early this month was quite entertaining reading. So yes, I mean, you mentioned that the band did split up at one point in their history, but then in the mid-2000s, they started performing together again. And that's where this story begins, because this documentary maker, filmmaker, producer guy by the name of Robert Carruthers, that's when he started working with the band. And they worked on various shows and projects over the decade that followed. But this actual legal dispute all begins in the year 2015, so 5 years ago, when Carruthers, through a company that he ran called Anglo Atlantic Media, registered with the UK Trademark Registry, basically the band's logo. And so he filled out the form, he paid a little bit of money, he went through the trademark application process here in the UK, and was granted the trademark in the band's logo a year later. And of course, trademark law is another branch of intellectual property. We don't talk about it as much here on Setlist as we do about copyright law, but nevertheless, it is an important branch of intellectual property for the music industry, because lots of bands, their brand, their name is really important for when they are touring, when they are doing stuff with media and with brands, and of course on the merchandise side of the business. So most bands these days, once they get to a certain point in their career, will want to protect their name, protect their brand by registering a trademark. And so that's what Carruthers did. He registered the trademark with the logo, but it transpired subsequently that he had done that without telling the band. So the band didn't know that that trademark was being registered. And so then, even though the trademark by this point had been issued, with hindsight, having seemingly fallen out with Carruthers, the band then went to the Trademark Registry, which is part of the Intellectual Property Office here in the UK, and said, we didn't know that trademark was being registered. That logo should belong to us, not to this guy, even though we've been working with that guy. And so we want you, the IPO, to invalidate that trademark. And so a very long, angry, multi-layered legal dispute occurred, both within the Intellectual Property Office through the process you go through when you're disputing a trademark, but subsequently also through the High Court in London.
Yeah, so the band went to the IPO and argued that Carruthers had registered the trademark in bad faith and said that therefore it should be invalidated. There were then various arguments presented on either side of this, but the band were ultimately successful. The IPO agreed that the registration had been done in bad faith and ruled last year, unless there is an agreement to the contrary, which I have found there was not, or unless the band is created by a record company, which it is not, persons or businesses who engage with a band in the way that Anglo-Atlantic Media and Carruthers has should not be registering trademarks, the effect of which would be to put them in complete control of the name of the band they represent, and which would have the potential effect of preventing the band from undertaking the activities it should be free to do under its own name.
So yeah, that was in the IPO's ruling on this matter last year, and quite an interesting statement there from a music industry perspective in general, because it is quite often the case that managers who work with artists will help the artists or the bands register their trademarks when they get to the point in their career where that seems like an appropriate thing to do. And what the IPO was confirming is, in essence, that a band's brand, their name, should belong to the band itself unless a contract says otherwise. And a big part of the dispute between the band and Carruthers was who had the better claim to the name, who had invested the time, the energy, the money to build the reputation on which that brand is built. And then there was a big discussion about whether or not the brand had originated back when the band were created, and therefore the people who were in the original incarnation of the band clearly had ownership of the mark, or whether or not we should only count what's happened since the 2005 reunion shows, etc., etc. But ultimately, yes, what the IPO was saying was that when a group of people come together, they form a band, and then there's a brand, and that brand can be trademarked. That brand will belong to the members of the band. Now, actually, quite often when we get trademark disputes like this in the music industry, the issue is that the members of the band have fallen out and then they can't agree on which band members should get it. But that wasn't the dispute here. The dispute here was between the band and then one of their business partners. And basically, the IPO were conferring that when a business partner is involved in helping to grow the brand and in registering the trademark, nevertheless, that brand and the intellectual property in that brand should belong to the band unless a contract says otherwise. So there could have been a contract in which the band allowed Carruthers to register the trademark and take ownership of that intellectual property. But in the absence of that agreement, the trademark should belong to the band. And that was why the IPO invalidated the trademark, which had been added to the trademark registry in 2016.
Yeah, the IPO ruling went on noting that Carruthers had invested both time and money into the band through the various projects that they'd worked on together, but said, honest people in the trade observing acceptable standards of behaviour would do so by relying on the remuneration from such activities to recoup their investment. If they were concerned about not gaining sufficient remuneration, then some sort of exclusive representation agreement should have been agreed. The use of the trademark system is not the correct mechanism for the protection they seek, even if Mr. Carruthers designed the figurative elements of the mark.
So that was the ruling at the Intellectual Property Office last year, but the reason why this story continued to now is concurrent to all of this, there was also separate legal action related to the dispute in the High Court. Because even as the IPO was still considering the ban's claim to invalidate the trademark, Carruthers filed papers with the High Court, basically criticising the conduct of the band and their supporters and some of the things that the band had said in relation to this dispute and as part of the formal IPO proceedings, and accused the band and their supporters of unlawfully conspiring to publish malicious falsehoods, misrepresenting their right to the name, and infringing his company's trademark. So even once the IPO dispute had been settled and the trademark had been invalidated and the band had won, we then had the issue of the action being pursued for the High Court, which required another round of arguing and witness statements and people making representations on both sides. And it is that dispute that we've had a very recent judgment on. And basically, the band won round two as well.
Yes, in a ruling earlier this month, the judge overseeing the case at the High Court concluded that Carruthers' legal claims were totally without merit. He also said that the filings to the court had been incomplete, but at the same time, prolix, which is that's a good word that we all need to start using in normal conversation, I think.
Yes, prolix means tediously lengthy, which I suppose makes that quite an interesting statement by the judge, because he was basically saying that the legal filings made by Carruthers' company, Anglo Atlantic Media, were both incomplete but at the same time tediously lengthy. So basically saying a whole load of waffle about a load of stuff, yet at the same time, the arguments contained in these legal filings were not properly set out. And I mean, the judge was pretty damning about the legal claims in general. There was a whole load of other stuff in the lawsuit as well. The judgment did go through in some detail most of the arguments that Carruthers had previously presented, but one of his conclusions was the overall impression one gets from the witness statements is that Mr. Carruthers is on a mission to defeat the band and raises every point he can think of, regardless of relevance, in order to achieve his aim.
Yeah, it's an entertaining ruling to read. Now, we wouldn't normally put the full rulings in the show notes when we report on stories like this, but this one is so entertaining I'm going to, because I think everyone should read it.
Although it is quite long, a warning. The legal claims were so prolix that the judgment is quite prolix. That's not true. It's not tediously lengthy. It's just lengthy.
It's quite lengthy, yeah.
But anyway,
what's the word for quite lengthy? Quite lengthy, but not tedious.
There must be some legal or Latin term for that. But anyway, a double win for the band in this dispute. So certain band members put out a statement last week welcoming that. We should point out that the aforementioned Neil Innes sadly died while this dispute was ongoing. So he is no longer with us, but various other band members were putting out statements welcoming this ruling. So that included Larry Smith, who said that he and his bandmates had suffered monstrous threats, lies and claims that should never have been issued and then allowed to be processed in the first place. Meanwhile, his bandmate Rodney Slater added that while he felt victorious by the double win, first at the IPO and then in the High Court, he nevertheless carries the scars of 2 years of tactical, vexatious litigation when all he was trying to do was legitimately defend what was his. And he cautioned other artists who might be looking to defend their intellectual property, their brands in similar disputes, to not try this at home until the law is reformed. Which I guess brings us to the campaign element of this story, because the band have said that they feel that all of this happened because of a loophole in the law where people are able to register trademarks linked to an artist or a band without checking that whoever is making the trademark registration has a legitimate claim to the band or the artist's brand and the intellectual property assigned to it.
So with all that in mind, the band said in a joint statement last week that with the assistance of Kerry McCarthy MP and the Musicians Union, we now intend to assist the IPO and Parliament in closing a loophole that allows anyone to appropriate a band name by paying a £200 fee without having to provide adequate proof of ownership. Similarly, we wish to see more safeguards for witnesses so that they are not subjected to intimidation via the courts.
Yes, so although the actual legal dispute element of this story is seemingly at an end, the campaign element is now beginning. So it will be interesting to see how the band and their supporters in Westminster proceed with this and whether or not there can be some extra protections, extra rules put in place specific to band names, performer names, artist names in the trademark registration process to make sure that this doesn't happen to any other artists in the future. So we will keep an eye on that, and no doubt, if developments occur, we'll come back to them and explain them on future editions of Setlist.
And finally this week, we promised you last week that we would try to find you something in this week's episode that was not a dispute, and we have done that. Unfortunately, it is COVID-19 related, so we have not fully delivered on our promise, so sorry about that. But a few weeks into lockdown, some interesting trends are emerging in the commercial radio industry.
Yeah, I think we possibly alluded to this on a previous edition of Setlist, that since lockdown began in various continental European countries and then here in the UK and then subsequently in North America, lots of people have been crunching the stats about what impact that has had on listening and consumption on the streaming services, but also consumption and listening on traditional radio stations. And one of the stories that we have seen in various countries during the lockdown period is that whereas people were expecting that the minute everybody was on lockdown and they were confined to their homes, that there might be a massive spike in people listening in to the Spotify's and Apple Music's of this world, actually, at the outset of lockdown, has slightly started to change since then. But at the outset of lockdown, streaming consumption levels were actually down. Meanwhile, there was plenty of stats out there suggesting that listening to old school radio was on the way up. I mean, I say listening to old school radio. Actually, when it comes to the way that we measure how many people are tuning in to AM and FM radio stations and even to DAB digital radio stations, well, the way that's measured, let's just say, is not super precise. But actually, quite a lot of the early chatter about the fact that as a result of lockdown, radio listening was up was actually based on radio stations online listening. So old school linear radio, but accessed through the internet or through an app or through an Alexa device. And obviously, when it comes to online radio listening, it is easier to actually measure how many people are tuning in versus people turning on an old school radio and listening via AM, FM and DAB. But yes, there's been lots of stats doing the rounds suggesting that one of the big winners in terms of audience share as a result of lockdown in multiple countries around the world is radio. And here in the UK, the organisation that represents commercial radio, an organisation called Radio Centre, they put out a bunch of stats last week, seemingly to confirm that.
Yeah, they surveyed a little over 1,000 people about their listening habits during lockdown and found that 38% of people who listen to commercial radio are tuning in for an extra hour and 45 minutes per day while on lockdown. That means they're now listening for an average of 26 hours per week compared to 14 hours per week pre-lockdown. And it's the people who are newly working from home is the category they've identified, who are really driving that shift.
Yeah, whenever we talk about radio listening figures, often a distinction is made between number of listeners and listening hours, because what radio stats over the last 10 years have generally shown is that with the exception of a younger demographic, where actually I think something much more significant and challenging is happening, but when you look at sort of, you know, the slightly older demographic, the number of people listening to the radio has been pretty static. So the rise of online channels outside of the sort of the youth demographic hasn't had a huge negative impact on radio yet. But what has been going down for a long time is number of listening hours. So the trend over the last decade has generally been that people are still tuning into the radio, but they're not tuning in for as long, suggesting that maybe they're still listening to the radio when they're getting up in the morning and they're driving to work or they're on their commute. But in the afternoon, in the evening, at the weekend, when maybe they would have also turned on the radio in the past, maybe that's when they're going to a Spotify or an Apple or to, you know, one of the other online services, whether that be video on demand or gaming or whatever. So this distinction between number of listeners and number of listening hours is important. And so, yes, I suppose the key thing there was what this Radio Centre research was suggesting was that as a result of lockdown, people are listening to radio for longer. And I guess what that is telling us, I mean, for those of us who work in the music industry, we assume that even if you work in a big office, there's always music playing in the background. Because when you work in the music industry, generally, we have music on. Now, that may be the radio, it may be Spotify, it may be something else. But we're used to working in environments where even in offices, music will be playing. But of course, a lot of people work in places where it's either not appropriate to be playing music or they're not allowed to play music, or maybe there is music playing, but it's some sort of in-store radio experience. So I guess that might be one of the reasons behind this, simply that people who don't usually work in places where music or radio is an option are now working at home. They have more control over their working experience, and they're all turning the radio on as a result.
Yeah, certainly one of the reasons for the increased listening could be that people were just allowed to listen to the radio while they're working where they haven't been in the past. Radio Centre did ask people about this in its survey and found that one of the big reasons was that people were using radio versus something like a streaming service because they wanted to feel in touch with the outside world. In fact, 90% of those surveyed said that this was one of the reasons for their increased radio listening, either as a means to help them stay informed or just to feel like they'd got some sort of human company while they were on lockdown. And in most cases, people actually gave both of those as a reason. And on the staying informed side of that, Radio Centre also asked why people were tuning into radio for their news. And a relatively high number of people, 68%, said that they felt that commercial radio was a trusted source of news. And 51% said that they trust radio news more than other sources.
So that all sounds like really good news for the radio industry, particularly a radio industry which has felt the pressure of competing with all these online services in recent years. Although it has to be said that there is also some negative news from the radio industry in this last week. And in some ways, it's the reverse of what we talked about a few weeks ago. A few weeks ago, when we were noting that, despite what people expected, overall listening on the streaming services was down, one thing we pointed out was that actually, commercially speaking, because of the way the streaming music business works, and because most of the money in music streaming is made by selling premium subscriptions, actually, consumption levels, to an extent, commercially speaking, don't matter. People may be listening to less music on Spotify and Apple. They may be tuning into Spotify and Apple for fewer hours per week. But commercially, providing they continue to pay their £10, $10, €10, whatever, a month, providing that direct debit continues to go out of their bank account, it doesn't actually matter how many people are tuning in. And we can say a similar thing about the radio industry, because obviously for commercial radio, how do they make money? They make money selling advertising. So what matters for radio isn't how many people are tuning in, it's how many advertisers are paying to advertise. So the same principle applies to radio, except for radio, it's a bad principle, because their narrative is listening numbers, listening hours are up, that's a good thing, but are the advertisers advertising? Because however many people may be tuning in, what matters is how much ad income is coming in at the end of the month. So actually what we're seeing in the radio sector is listening is up and that's brilliant, but for some radio stations, because the advertising sector is wobbling as a result of the COVID-19 shutdown, commercially they're actually facing a number of challenges.
Yes, and in addition to that Radio Centre research last week, the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Commercial Radio wrote to the Treasury, the Cabinet Office and the Department of Digital Culture, Media and Sport in the UK government last week, calling for special support for commercial radio stations in the UK during the COVID-19 pandemic. That letter warned that many radio stations have seen ad sales fall significantly since the COVID-19 shutdown began and could face closure entirely if the government doesn't step in.
Yeah, so the letter from this APPG, the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Commercial Radio, was saying that lots of commercial radio stations were struggling despite the increase in listeners because ad sales were down. And they stressed that it was affecting the smaller radio stations more. I mean, that's kind of a common theme throughout all of the COVID-19 shutdown, isn't it? That the small businesses, the smaller companies tend to be hardest hit. And in the radio space, that's because the small independent local radio stations, there are still some of those here in the UK, not very many, but there are some. And the more local a radio station, the more they rely on local advertising rather than big brand advertising. So the taxi companies, the pizza companies, etc., etc. And obviously, lots of local businesses are either shut, so they have nothing to advertise, or they're having huge cash flow challenges at the moment. So one of the first things to go will be the money that you hand over every week to the local radio station. So they were basically saying that all of this is hitting the small, independent local stations even more than the big national networks.
Yeah, so this letter said, "The government has taken extraordinary steps to protect businesses. Yet there is a risk that without further help, that some commercial radio stations could end up being forced off air." It went on to say that specific support the government could provide include relief on high fixed transmission costs, an extension of current financial schemes to commercial broadcasters, and an increase in spending on radio advertising by government departments, which are obviously putting out lots of COVID-19 advice adverts across the media at the moment.
Yeah, so give less of that ad spend to Facebook and Instagram and more to your local radio station, I think is what they were saying. Obviously, long term, it could be that the radio industry is one of the winners of the COVID-19 shutdown because, as I say, with a younger demographic, it does feel like the radio industry, to an extent, has almost lost a generation. You have a generation of people who were brought up with YouTube, music on demand, more recently Spotify, Apple Music, etc., who are not as likely to choose to tune into radio stations in a way that that generation would have been 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago. Now, obviously, the devil is in the detail. All these stats suggesting that the listening numbers and listening hours are up, maybe they're all people over the age of 28. But if younger people are also tuning in, then maybe these radio stations have an opportunity to build a long-term relationship with that audience, which means that once all of this is over, once the advertising industry swings back into action, they'll have a bigger audience and be able to capitalise on that. But as the APPG is saying, like companies in pretty much every sector, and certainly across the music and media and entertainment sectors, facing some significant challenges at the moment, and the slight sort of irony that listening figures, listening hours are up, but revenues are down. Meanwhile, as we've said, for the record industry, a similar principle actually is good news for the Spotify's and Apple's and the record companies of this world, because even if overall consumption on the streaming services is going down, actually, as lockdown continues, those listening figures are going back up again. But crucially, from a record industry perspective, actually how many people are tuning in doesn't matter. What matters is how many people are paying those monthly subscriptions, because most of the money in music streaming comes from a premium.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, if they are getting younger listeners in who are becoming more used to and warming to the human interaction, or, you know, perceived human interaction of radio, then that would be interesting to see how that affects things after this is all over. Because quite early on in the lockdown, I mean, obviously this isn't a commercial station, but the BBC's Six Music station, because they didn't have enough presenters in, some shows were being replaced with just playlists. And so I'd switch it on at dinner time and it would just be playing a playlist, basically. And very quickly, I realised what I was missing from radio and what I get from radio, because I was just like, well, there's no... I mean, they're still playing music I like, but why don't I just put on my own playlist if this is what they're going to be putting out? Because I can get 100% music I want to listen to that way. And without any interjections from a presenter, it did feel very strange. So that human connection is definitely a really key part of radio and a reason to be listening to it.
Yeah, so maybe the radio industry will be able to reconnect with people they've lost, or indeed connect with younger people who they've never really connected with before. The radio industry can have a revival, and radio companies can stop trying to reinvent themselves as podcast companies. Leave us podcasters doing the podcasting thing.
Yes, leave us alone to do this, which you've just said at the point when we're finished.
Yeah.
So well done. We have come to the end of this week's episode. But while you're there, if you want to help us boost our listener figures, and I don't see why you wouldn't, you could go on whatever app you're listening to this on and see if it's possible to write us a review. And if it is, then do that, or at the very least, give us a nice little star rating, because that sort of thing helps with this sort of thing. And you could also just, I mean, I often say go out and tell people about it, but you can't do that at the moment. Maybe on Thursday, while you're clapping, shout that you really like the Setlist podcast and people should listen to it. Maybe make a sign that says that's who you're clapping for this week.
I'm not sure stealing the NHS's weekly moment of glory is an appropriate thing to be doing in the current crisis. But, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you should try it and see.
Well, you never know unless you try it, do you? So, yeah, do definitely do that. And we'll get back to you on what boost it gave us. But for now, yeah, that's the end of the show. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.